Please welcome Dick Skelly from the East Marietta Group.
What are you, abandoning me? Just trying to get out of the line of fire, I guess. My name is Dick Skelly, and I'm an alcoholic. At this point in time, I hope I'm an alcoholic. If I'm not, I've wasted 37 years of my life coming to these damn meetings. And they selected me, I guess, because I've been in AA a pretty long time. It's obvious from looking at me, I've been somewhere for a pretty long time. Two things came to mind. I was 2-3 months sober when I came to my first Atlanta Roundup, and it must have been in July of 77. And your speaker was Ray O'Keefe. And Ray has since passed, but Ray was an alcoholic and an attorney, so I guess it runs in the profession. And I got a kick out of the warning about the cell phones. I've noticed over time that the cell phone headsets are getting smaller and smaller to the point where you can't distinguish the cell phone users from the real schizophrenics. Yeah, I don't mind that lady behind me in line talking to herself, but when she starts arguing, you know, I'm out of there. I want to first thank the committee, Eric and John, Jack, for having the extreme good judgment to invite me here. My home group is the East Marietta Group. That's the East Marietta Group. Both of them. But they'll be meeting tomorrow night, and I'll be here at this roundup, knowing full well that back in East Marietta, things will not be going quite as well as they should. I want to apologize, or at least explain. I use notes. These are for your benefit. Without the discipline of notes, we could be here till 2 or 3 in the morning. And you could be going home delighted with your bargain. Look, 5 CDs for $7. But it does keep me in line because in addition to being an alcoholic, I'm also a Celtic mystic. For the uninformed among you, a Celtic mystic is an Irish bullshitter. And another note, just to apologize, I'm wearing a suit. I make my living as a lawyer, and I usually wear a vest. There's a story behind the vest. I always knew I was a high-bottom drunk because I had to hold in my silk tie when I threw up. I got around that by wearing a vest. The vest held it in, except the vest created other problems. I used to stagger into the men's room, open my vest, pull out my tie, and pee in my pants. Things were very confused in those days. Like a lot of people, I started using alcohol because it worked. It did the things it was supposed to do. By the way, I want to tell the signing lady that there's a lot of things I say that for which there are no signs. But I drank in the beginning because it worked. It did the things it was supposed to do for me. In my late teens and early 20s, drink made me comfortable talking with girls. A little bit later, as I got into college and law school, I went to college and law school on scholarships. And as a result, I was with a lot of people who were paying their own freight. And at that time, especially in law school, I wasn't going to school with the sons and daughters of doctors and bankers and judges. My dad was a steel worker. And after classes, we would adjourn. The Catholic Archdiocese of Newark was kind enough to place Seton Hall Law School right next to a tavern. How considerate could they be? You know? And I'd go to that tavern with my classmates, and they'd be talking about their prep school lacrosse team. And I didn't go to a prep school. I didn't play lacrosse. I went to a small parochial high school. I played stickball in a playground. But after a couple of drinks, what the hell, I played lacrosse too. And I drank as alcohol worked, and then at some point in time, alcohol stopped working. I remember I didn't get sober till May of 77, but my first AA meeting was sometime in January. I had gone there to pick up some pamphlets to get the heat off at home. And I picked up those pamphlets and brought them home. I came in the house drunk that night, and I staggered into the kitchen, threw the pamphlets on the table in front of my wife, and insisted that the damn thing didn't work. And I guess it was sometime around March or April, I had a trial coming up. And at this time in my career, I prepared myself for trial by putting myself on half rations of liquor for 2 weeks before trial and went in all prepared. And I went in on this occasion, and the district attorney told me he was going to be asking for a continuance because his chief witness, a police officer, had been activated by his guard or reserve unit, and he was going to request a continuance. Well, I was furious. Fury was my first reaction. My second reaction was frustration, because I could not argue to that judge, "Your Honor, I've had myself on half rations of liquor for the last 2 weeks. Who do you think you are granting a continuance?" And I went through these things, and at the same time, my family was being destroyed. I didn't know how much until I was sober a short time, and I look back at those many times when I was supposed to pick up my daughter from daycare, but I was drinking, and I would wind up always being a half hour, an hour late, and paying the $15 or so for being late. And when I got criticized for that, my response was, "What are you worried about? I paid the $16. Like, that was all there was to it. It took me a couple of years sober, and talking and being sober with women in this program, to finally look at the terror in her eyes and the sense of abandonment at a father who apparently didn't care and sometime wasn't there. And it didn't sink in on me until a year or two sober. And I owe that to the women in the program, because they recited some of the things that happened to them. And I finally had to make an amends, and most of that amends to a 7-year-old who was being a good father to her for the rest of the time in my home. But I never got to recognize that. I owe that to the women. I always say that the men got me sober, but the women keep me sober. And not you, these other women. And I always have this affinity and affection for the women in the program, mostly stemming from religious grounds, they were very devout heterosexual. But learning things, they have the pieces that I don't have. They help me fill in some of the missing parts. My wife is one of those. She's not here tonight. We had a call to come take care of one of the grandchildren. My wife on Saturday will celebrate 5 years in this program. And it's apparently an infectious disease with a long incubation period. But we've been married. We'll be married 47 years this September. I've only been sober 37. I got through the first 10 years on charm. Now, as much as I owe to the women, I want you to know you're by no means perfect. Several years ago at 8111, a fellow came into a meeting. He had been 5 years sober and had just been released from jail. He got sober in jail. And he told a little bit of his story at the meeting, and I went and spoke to him for about a half hour after the meeting. And when I got done talking with him, I was on my way to the car, and one of the women who had seen me speaking with him came over and asked, what was he in prison for? So about 17 years ago, in a drunken rage, he shot and killed his wife. She said, oh, then he's single? We all get something different out of the meetings, don't we? But we lawyers have barriers to sobriety. Sobriety is primarily a disease of consequences. If you're an alcoholic who keeps drinking, more and more consequences fall upon you. And we lawyers make our living postponing, diminishing, eliminating consequences. That's what we do. And we put them off to a point where we can wind up doing more harm to ourselves because we don't have to pay the consequences. Before I got here, because I was a professional, I took my problems to another professional. I went to a psychiatrist. And I paid him what was then $90 an hour for the privilege of lying to him. I didn't really lie. I told him only as much as I thought he needed to know to help me. Apparently, I misjudged. But he had to spend his earlier career in the Navy, was naval intelligence. And at some point in our discussions, he told me that I would make an excellent prisoner of war. Hey, everybody has a talent, you know? And I was going to a doctor, MD at the time, and getting all the drugs and the treatments I could, and he finally told me if I didn't stop drinking, I was going to die. And I remember telling him, I've never been that lucky. And I started coming here in, I guess it was May of 1977. And I remember hearing, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. So you don't quit. And you find out the miracle was the ability to wait 5 minutes. For me, I guess that I went to my first meeting, I picked up the pamphlet, so I went back to Rebus. I don't know if you've been to Rebus. There are people I hear at the meeting saying, I came into AA and I knew I was home. Well, I got sober at Rebus and I don't know what the hell kind of home you had. I did not think I was home when I got to Rebus. There were people there. I remember they had a bunch of tables there and they had a non-smoking table. It's like having a non-peeing part of the swimming pool, you know? Like, And it was a guy there, this was my first was sober just a couple of weeks. And I was at that stage when I was still debating whether I belonged there. They read it in the book, it says, being convinced. I was convinced, but not yet persuaded. So I was going to meetings just, you know, at the jumping off point, where I was going to stay or go. And in those days, there was a fellow, many of you may remember him, his name was Speedy. Speedy died about 2.5 years ago. And this was in the mid-70s. And Speedy Moore came over to me resplendent in a lime green leisure suit with white patent leather shoes and a matching belt and a buckle you could serve a turkey on. Remember, he walked over to me, he said, "You want what we have?" Not right now. Later on, I got a bit jealous. At one point, we formed a law firm, which was made up of all guys in recovery. We had met in the program, and I guess, practiced for about 12, 13 years together. And one of my law partners got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. Well, that pissed me off. I got sober at goddamn Rebus. He got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Springs. That grated on me. I always resented people with material advantages. And it bothered me for a while till I remembered why I didn't get sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. It's because when I got sober, Betty Ford was still drinking. You should never, however, never let facts get in the way of your resentments. So I went, I just came here because, you know, even with Speedy and that stuff, I tried everything else, you know. And I was raised to believe you should try anything once except incest and folk dancing. So I figured I'd try AA, and I remember getting here. I got to a meeting. It was a 10:30 a.m. meeting. They called it the Swingers Club. Because they did it because it was served the swing ship out of Lockheed. But I remember getting there in that group. They had the habit of the 12-step chairman would assign you a temporary sponsor if you didn't have one. Even if you didn't want one, you had one before you left there. And I had this fellow, he was, what's the word? He was inflicted on me. And I remember getting him and talking to him early on. I said, "Yeah, how many of these meetings I have to go to?" He said, "Well, we'll talk to you about that a little bit later." A few days later, he came over to me. He said, "We've been talking it over. We decided that a man of your obvious intelligence and extensive education, that you ought to go to 7 meetings a week." I said, "That's every day." He said, "See, you're getting better already." But I got here, and under his guidance, I started working the program. It was battered and scarred, and an auctioneer hardly thought it worthwhile to spend much time on the old violin, but he held it up with a smile. "What am I bid for this fiddle?" he said. "Who'll start the bidding for me?" $1 then. "Who'll make it $2? $2. Who'll make it $3? $3 once, $3 twice, and going and going. But no, from the back of the room, an older man stepped forward and picked up the bow. And wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening its loosened string, he played a melody pure and rich as caroling angels sing. The music finished, and the auctioneer, in a voice that was hushed and low, said, "What am I bid for this fine violin?" And he held it up with a bow. $1,000. Who'll make it two? 2,000. Who'll make it three? 3,000 once, 3,000 twice, and going and gone, said he. The crowd stood and cheered, but some of them said, "We just don't understand. What changed its worth?" Quick came the reply, "The touch of the master's hand." And my sobriety has been a continuing touch from my God, my master. I got into the 12 steps. In my case, they were the 12 missteps. I remember taking that first step. I knew I was powerless over alcohol, but I didn't think my life was unmanageable. After all, I had 4 DUI arrests, no convictions. That's manageable. I did this because I always carried a half-empty half-pint under my seat. So if I did get stopped, I'd stop the car, take the keys in one hand, the pint in the other, get out of the car and polish off the pint in front of the cop. Later on, when I flunked the breathalyzer, it was impossible to tell whether it was a result of drinking I did after I stopped driving or before I stopped driving. I was insane. I wasn't stupid. Don't try that anymore, by the way. Georgia law has changed. Now, say if you're tested, you're presumed to have been that way for a couple of hours. It's called Dick's Law. Not really. Not really. And that second step, I asked for as much sanity as I could handle. That second step, it doesn't ask me to believe in anything. It asks me to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. at the time, I was raised a Catholic, but I hadn't been a good one for a long time. I was may have been a functional agnostic. I'd never be an atheist. In fact, I felt sorry for atheists. They have nothing to holler out in the middle of sex. And that third step, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. When you hear people discussing the third step, you regularly hear them, "Well, I turned it over, and then I took it back. But then I turned it over again, but then I took it back again." The operative phrase in that step is not turn it over. The operative phrase is make a decision. It requires no action at the moment. The first three steps are positional steps, intellectual steps. Admit, believe, decide. There's nothing to do. There's a friend of mine who's a pilot in a program who told me it on a flight from Atlanta to San Francisco, in terms of hairline computer accuracy, that plane is only on course about 2% of the time. The rest of the time, it's correcting. And that's what we do. The third step, we set the course. And if we're having set it, we now know when we're off it. And that step is for just that purpose, to measure and set the course. That fourth step, I remember it was this time of the year. I got sober in May, and in July, mid-July, my sponsor was going on vacation. And he told me, he said, "Write your fourth step, when we get back, we'll do your fifth step." I said, "Fourth step?" He said, "Yeah, you had a lot of anger and resentment." And I didn't think I had any anger and resentment. In fact, it really pissed me off when he told me that. So I did my inventory. The first one was one of those searchless and fearful moral inventories. But he got back, and we did a fifth step. A fifth step asks you to admit to God yourself and another human being. I could not find another human being, so I used my sponsor. And then that fifth step is crucial, because it's the time you've let go. You haven't told everybody, but you let go of the secrets. And now you don't have to walk around in that defensive posture covering it up anymore. You can open yourself up to the fellowship and the world at large, not because everybody knows, but because you've let go of it. And having let go, you're no longer carrying that burden. One of the people I sponsored was a Methodist minister, and he told me he thought one of the greatest mistakes of the Reformation was the abandonment of the practice of confession. You tell somebody it's out of you, and you can live now. It's no longer a secret. And that sixth step tells us we are entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. It says ready. In the law, we have a phrase, ready, willing, and able. There are three different things. Ready just means you've done the work necessary in advance. It tells you in the book to go through those first five steps, see if you've done them as well as you can. If you have, you are ready. I was a DCM for my home zone for a while, and my alternate DCM was an engineer. He was kind of obsessive. And we'd be down in Macon at the assembly. We had a meeting at 9 o'clock. He called me at 6:45. Now, at 6:45, I was willing to go to that meeting, but I was not yet ready. I had not done the necessary things to go to that meeting. So there is a difference. And the seventh step, it says, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. My reading of that is that the reason we use the word humbly is because we are asking him to take things that we of our own will might not be willing to let go of, but we're asking him to take them anyhow. I think that is the humbly in that step. Now, it does not read, asked him to remove our shortcomings, and he did. I still have most of the shortcomings I came here with. They just don't run my life anymore. It used to be if you came and told me you didn't like my tie, that gave me the right to burn down your house with your wife and your kitchen. I've developed a sense of proportion now. And still after 37 years, some little old lady cuts me off on the expressway, I might still speed up to give her the finger. After 37 years, however, I just don't follow her past my exit. And that eighth step tells us to write our inventory. Why do we write it? We don't have to write it to remind ourselves who we harmed. We know who we harmed. We write it out so we can sit down with a sponsor or some other trusted member and review it before we go fumbling out there to deal with earth people, which we're completely inequipped to do. There may be things in there he can tell you how to try to make that amend or how to approach it. There may be people in there you shouldn't approach just yet. They may still have the knife in their back. But you write that down so you can review it with someone before you go running out there to make the amends. And in that ninth step, it tells us to make direct amends. When I first got sober, I jumped ahead. I was really going to run around and apologize to everybody. He said, you're a lawyer. What does amend mean? I said, it means to change. That's right. change. If you come home drunk and knock over your neighbor's mailbox, you don't owe him an apology, you owe him a mailbox. That's your amen. Make the amen. Excuse me. And when you do so, you've kind of freed yourself up with outsiders now. You don't have to walk across the street when you see that guy coming toward you. You know, you can walk up to him and say hello. If for no other reason than to piss him off. You know. The 10th step says continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I used to read that as if we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That saves a lot of admitting, you know. Just like they tell us in the book, contempt prior to investigation. Contempt prior to investigation will save you a lot of investigating time. In that 11th step, it asks us to prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. I was raised in the Catholic school. We had prayers. We had prayers for everything. We had prayers for the men in service, and prayers for the Pope, and prayers for the President. Meditation was, we had prayers for the crops. I grew up in New Jersey. We didn't have any crops. The guy in the corner growing marijuana, but I don't think that was included in our prayers. Meditation was a bit strange to me. I always thought of it something as vaguely Eastern. And really is nothing magic about it. Is not to sit there and make your mind blank. Meditation, it's from the Greek, meditare, to think about. Think about things and see what God can tell you as you're thinking about them. You may get an insight of, oh, I did that wrong last time. Maybe I can correct it. 100 things can come to you. And all you have to do is think about them. In that 11th step, they tell us, as Bill treats of it, that even in times of grief and sorrow, when the hand of God seemed heavy or even unjust, new resources of courage were uncovered and new lessons in life were learned. We realized that his will for us was best. And, that came to me. It was important in my life, and we'll get into it for a few minutes later. The 12th step tells us that as having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, a lot of people confuse that with Bill's experience in Towns Hospital. That's not what it was. As the result of these steps had not been created. Bill may have taken one or two of them inadvertently, but that spiritual awakening was not a result of these steps. It was fairly unique to Bill. In fact, the old-timers referred to that as Bill's hot flash. You know, it almost distracted me because I was, between the time I got to my first meeting and picked up the pamphlets and the books and the time I got sober in May, I would sit and read the big book of an evening, and I'd have a glass of scotch in one hand in the big book in the other, which is, by the way, is not the best way to go through the big book. But I remember trying to track Bill to his life in New England with the kids in World War I and back on Wall Street, and he's drinking the whole time. And when does he get sober? So he goes into the hospital and says, oh, maybe this is where he gets sober. And he talks about the wind and the light. And I says, damn, I got to wait for the wind and the light to come through here. And then I'll put this drink down. But I had read the big book, by the way. At the time, I had taken one of those Evelyn Wood speed reading courses. And I went through that big book in about 45 minutes. You know? And I was ready for the quiz, you know. What do you want to know? I'll tell you. when I went through it the second time, my sponsor had me go through. And I kept making notes in the margin because at 2 weeks sober, I thought I had, you know, some good ideas for the next edition. I may be the only sponsee in the history of this program whose sponsor took away his big book. He told me to go to meetings and listen. He'd let me know when I was ready to read. And I took those 12 steps and they began to work in my life. And many of us with life out of time and battered and scarred within sold ourselves cheap to the passing crowd, much like that old violin. A night in a tavern, a round of drinks, some jokes, and he travels on. He's going once, going twice, going and almost gone. But the power comes, and the foolish crowd can never quite understand the worth of a soul. The grave that's lost with the touch of the master's hand. I did 12-step work, most of the phone calls and the like we talk about. My name was on the 12-step list. And by the way, it's always worthwhile to do that. Most of the calls you get will be people looking for directions or out-of-towners. But every once in a while, you'll get a wet one. And he will talk to you in the most insane alcoholic drivel for 45 minutes, and you will know exactly what he's talking about. Now, we get 12-step calls. People complain about getting them at midnight and one in the morning. Mine used to come at supper time. And we had four kids. I mentioned we were Catholic. And supper time at a house with four kids can be kind of hectic. And I'd go get the phone call, and if it seemed like he was all right or close to it, I'd try to meet him around 7 o'clock. This way, if things worked out, I could take him right to an 8 o'clock meeting. And I announced this to my wife, and she said, well, you know, before you go, can you help me get the kids ready for bed? Well, sure. You ever try and convince a 2- and a 4-year-old that just because you're putting pajamas on now does not mean you have to go to bed right now? You know, let Daddy help you with your pajamas. It's not bedtime. No, you put them on now, you go to bed. You're going to make me go to bed. No, I'm not. Just put your pajamas on. Mommy, Daddy's going to make us go to bed. God damn it, put your pajamas on. And I'd be leaving. When do you be back? As soon as I give this son of a bitch some of my serenity. And the other part of that is sponsorship. A lot of people sponsor the way they were sponsored, just like you may be parent the way you were parented. The people I sponsor tend to have less than 6 months or more than 5 years. Somewhere around 6 months, they get sensitive. And one guy I was working with, he doing good sober-wise, but he was unemployed, and I told him, you know, you ought to get a job. Say, you know, something to do between meetings. And I'd approach him periodically, did you get a job? No, I didn't get a job. And finally, one time at a meeting, he comes running up to me, I got a job. I said, where are you working? He said, you know, Bed Bath & Beyond. And I asked him if he was in the Beyond department. He fired me, got another sponsor. As things improved me, I wound up getting a job with a group that gave seminars to doctors how to run the business end of a medical practice. They wanted a lawyer to be part of that. And luckily at that time, doctors were just getting into desktops, and this is mid-70s, mini computers. And our company offered to walk them through the acquisition process of how to get a computer, because they were smaller businesses who did not have programmers and systems analysts on their payroll. We offered the service, but most of the time they rejected it because they were doctors and they knew everything. And I get a call a couple of weeks later, you know, can you get me out of this contract? And I pick up and just learn what you had to learn to try a case. And after trying a couple of cases, I looked around at the knowledge I had of computer law and I said, you know, you're an expert. You know more about this now than 99% of the attorneys in the country. And we started working with the other attorneys and with insurance companies to expel that. And then people would come up to me and say, you know, computer law, wow, how'd you get into that? I said, I'd like to say it was a matter of astute career planning. But really what you do is you almost drink yourself to death. And you scramble for any job you can get. You take it. And in those early days, it was funny. I'd spend the mornings in depositions with systems engineers trying to get them to speak English. And in the afternoon, somebody from the program who was, you know, 10 weeks sober was facing a court date on something that happened 12 weeks earlier. And, you know, you do what you can. You go into court with them. And I'd stand there with the dark suit and this voice and just to approach the bench and say, Your Honor, the defendant was running naked down Highway 92 with a fistful of Q-tips up his butt. Insisting he was the Easter Bunny. But we do have an explanation, Your Honor. Sing Peter Cottontail for His Honor. But you go through these things, and when I do public defender work now, I'm semi-retired. I had one guy who was a college professor, but he got into marijuana and burned a lot of things away. He still had a full six-pack. He just didn't have that little plastic thing that holds it all together. And, you know, you help out where you can. I gone through these things. You have difficult times trying to get it. A lot of times you just don't do it. But one thing that kind of made up for everything else was about 12 years ago, a young girl at 8111, she was with a group of women that came in on a van from some women's treatment center. And she took me aside and said she had gotten a letter from the district attorney to go down to Fulton County for an interview. And I found out what had happened. Apparently, at the end of her drinking and drugging, she had become pregnant. And because of her drinking and drugging, she had miscarried the baby. And because she was taken to the hospital by law enforcement, this matter made its way to the district attorney's office, and some hotshot decided he was going to try her on Georgia's fetal drug and fetal alcohol law. So I did some research. I wrote him and told him in other states they had approved that she knew she was pregnant when she was taking the drugs. They might also have to prove that she knew the specific drug she was taking could permeate the placenta and damage the fetus. Well, he disappeared. We never heard from him again. And I guess he went after some more defenseless woman. And when this was over with Pat, it turned out about 2 months later, they had a little party at 8111. Pat, for all her trouble, had maintained a 4.0 grade point average at college and was now had applied for and admitted to the Georgia Medical School in Augusta, something that would not have been possible had she had a criminal record. And I saw her, she went off to school, I saw her periodically every couple of months, she'd be in on a break and I'd see her. And the last time I saw her, she was coming in and getting her stuff together. She had graduated and was going on to run a residency in pediatrics up in Kentucky. And I'd get an occasional postcard. Later on, I'd get an email or two. And a few years ago, in my home group, there was a girl named Susan who was also a physician. She lived in Savannah, and now she's a neurologist. And apparently at some point in their medical school, they had shared an apartment together. And Susan wrote to Pat and told her she had met me. And I got this letter that kind of makes up for a lot of other things. She started it as she always did. "My dear blessed and profane hero, Dick. I got a call from Susan last week after she returned from Marietta. She called to say how she spoke with you at some length and reports that you are, thank God, still the same. When we last met at 8111 a few years back, I had just graduated and was in the process of moving to Kentucky for my residency. You probably thought I was either trying to strangle you with hugs or drown you with tears. You seemed a bit embarrassed, but told me to show my gratitude by using my skills occasionally without pay to help others in need. You told me then that it was a rare blessing from God for people like us to be put in a position to do that. How can I ever forget how you did that for me? I pulled out your 3-page lawyer letter to the Atlanta authorities and read it again. It was at once strong and elegant and poetic. Your explanation to me, however, was less elegant and less poetic. As you summarized it, I threatened them with more shit than they could shovel. It's nice to have a bilingual attorney. As I've tried to follow your example and direction, there's no way to pay back what we owe. The only repayment is to pass it on. One weekend a month, we take a volunteer van to Harlan, Inverta, Everett's, for well baby care, vaccinations, and general pediatrics." What the hell is that? 13 years ago, I wrote a letter. And today, a couple hundred kids in Appalachia have a pediatrician. What is that? That was not me. That was not me. When I wrote that letter, I was a wise-ass defense attorney trying to get one up on a prosecutor. But God took that and did something with it. And when you have the opportunity, you do that because you never know. You just never know. Now, my journey here has not been all that different from most of you. When I got here, I had lost the family, the home, most of the money. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 2 years sober, my son Brendan needed open-heart surgery. And he was 5 years old, and we found out at that time that he was a retarded child. And I hurt, and I prayed, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 3 and 5 years sober, 2 more children were born to a reconstructed marriage. And I shared that joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 8 years sober, my youngest son, Kevin, at 5 years old, was diagnosed with cancer. And I hurt, and I prayed, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And at 8 years sober, he was declared cured of his cancer. And I shared that joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And at 20 years sober, my son Brendan died. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. It's just that simple. It's not easy, but it is simple. And here in this program, we are held to be honest. We're not held to truth. Truth is God's domain. We're only compelled to be honest. There's only one truth that I have to hold on to, and it's the truth with which I began my remarks to you this evening. And that truth is that my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.